Hello, and welcome to the COVID-19 and America's Return to Work webinar presented by Polsinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions for our speakers regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 support email as shown on your screen now. This contact information can also be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bio. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the technical support box for assistance. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Polsinelli shareholder Jay Dade.
Good afternoon or morning, depending on where you are from Kansas City. My name is Jay Dade, and I lead Polsinelli's National Management Labor Relations Practice Group. Welcome to today's webinar, COVID-19 and America's Return to Work, Organized Labor's Challenge to Union and Non-Union Employers. Thank you all for joining us. As the nation begins reopening and continues confronting the COVID-19 pandemic, employers face many challenges. One important challenge is that being raised by organized labor. During the next hour, my colleagues will provide insights into how employers can confront this challenge. I'm joined today by my colleagues Rob Enten from Chicago, Mark Nelson from Denver, Sarah Robertson from St. Louis, and Denise Delcor and Henry Thomas, who office along with me in Kansas City. They have a jam-packed hour for you, covering topics such as the ongoing and unprecedented opportunity for union activity, cautions for non-unionized workforces, considerations for unionized workforces, the upcoming November federal general election, and immediate actions all employers should consider, including lawful communications to their employees. I would say sit back and enjoy the webinar, but my colleagues have jam-packed the hour. As a law professor of mine would say, ladies and gentlemen, put on your track shoes. We have a lot to cover. And with that, I will throw this to Rob Enten. Rob?
Thanks, Jay. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're well, and I hope that your families are safe. Since the middle of March, I've had many conversations with my clients about how COVID-19 is going to lead to an increase in union activism. And often my clients, some who may be listening in right now, no names, have responded with a healthy dose of skepticism. What's different now, Rob? You were concerned about the Employee Free Choice Act, and that never came to be. 6 years ago, when the NLRB created the quickie or ambush election, you predicted a steep increase in union petitions. But the number of elections didn't increase the way the politicians and labor unions, and especially paranoid management attorneys, believed. Fight for 15, Janitors for Justice, may have made it more difficult for me to get to work a couple summers ago, but it never really swayed my employees. Why now? Why this? What's different this time? I think the best way to answer this question is to look at the confluence of circumstances all coming together at the same time. First is to re-examine what makes unions attractive in the first place. What does organized labor promise? Well, they promise higher wages, retirement savings, affordable health insurance, reasonable work schedules and days off, safety in the workplace, job security. Now, what have we seen over the past 10 weeks? Across the board reductions in compensation, layoffs and furloughs, 1 in 5 American workers unemployed, people losing health insurance or unable to make COBRA payments, employees who are dipping into their 401ks just to pay the bills. And for those who haven't lost their jobs, for our essential workers, some are working 6-day work weeks. Those have become the norm. 8-hour shifts are now aspirational. Employees are working harder and longer, and in many cases, for less money. What about safety in the workplace? Ask the RN who has bruises on her face from wearing a mask for 12 hours a day. Or the cashier at a grocery store who is handling goods from hundreds of strangers. Or store clerks being yelled at point-blank range from maskless customers, incensed that stores are refusing to allow them entry without wearing some type of facial protection. And how about all those employees who are scared to come to work, who are part of the vulnerable population, or taking care of family members who are at high risk, or those who are ill but can't miss a paycheck? You put all this into a mixing bowl, and then for the final ingredient, add in what has dominated the airwaves and news over the past 8 days, wherein cities big and small, anger precipitated by the murder of George Floyd has led to hundreds and thousands of people leaving their homes in the midst of a global pandemic in violation of shelter-in-place orders, social distancing be damned, to protest. Voila. You have a recipe of activism that has not been seen in decades. We know who has noticed. Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, the federation made up of 55 national and international unions, together representing more than 12 million active and retired workers. The AFL-CIO just filed a lawsuit against OSHA to issue an emergency temporary standard protecting U.S. workers against the coronavirus. In explaining the lawsuit, Trump has stated, since this crisis began, the Department of Labor and federal government has failed to meet their obligations and duty to protect workers. The government response has been delinquent, delayed, disorganized, chaotic, and totally inadequate. To date, OSHA has not passed any temporary standard and instead has only issued recommendations to employers as to how to keep employees safe. To date, OSHA has issued a single enforcement action despite receiving over 5,000 complaints. I believe that if Mr. Trumka was joining us at this presentation, he would state that the federal government is not going to adequately protect employees from workplace hazards due to COVID-19, but organized labor will. Look, I know what you're thinking. Rob, unions represent less than 7% of the privatized workforce. That number is steady, if not dropping. And also, we've done things. We pay market rates. It may have taken us a little bit to get PPE, but we're taking the temperatures of employees before they come to work. We've started administering COVID-19 tests, asking employees to answer a questionnaire about their health, telling them to stay home if they're ill. Some of you are providing leave pursuant to the FFCRA. Others have instituted hazard pay. Most of you have done a lot above and beyond what is required by OSHA or the CDC or your state departments of health. You're right, you have. But Amazon thought so too, and still, workers in a warehouse went on strike after many of their coworkers tested positive for COVID-19. Here in Cicero, Illinois, workers at United Scrap Metal walked off the job to protest safety conditions when one of their coworkers passed away due to the virus. Even gig economy workers like Instacart, Uber, and Lyft, who are all non-statutory employees and have no rights under the National Labor Relations Act, have engineered walkouts to protest unsafe conditions, all at a time in which 20% of the country is unemployed. And unions know it. According to Ian Gold with the Teamsters, we are at a time of an unprecedented amount of organic worker-led activity. Just the other day, unions received an assist from a federal judge who rejected the labor board's changes to the union election rule, holding that the board was required to solicit comments from the public pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act and could not unilaterally engage in substantive rulemaking. Rules that our clients eagerly were anticipating, like those including the timing of union election dates and voter lists, eligibility of observers, and the reinstitution of hearings before elections pertaining to voter eligibility. Organized labor is also becoming opportunistic because they can. Todd Crosby of the UFCW would say that he is working with activists to engage in rebellion and protests that may lead to a permanent organization and collective bargaining. Now, that's a message that can resonate. And part of the reasoning why it is resonating is due to the ease of communicating one's message through social media. A union organizer does not have to schedule a meeting at a restaurant or bar or a parking lot. Where employees in the past had to look over their shoulder and sneak in to a place to meet with their union organizer to avoid being followed by a suspicious supervisor or manager, now everybody has a computer in the palm of their hand. Unions are capitalizing on this non-traditional communication, the free flow of ideas and messaging and inducements to action can occur and is occurring with little to no face-to-face interaction. Now, this activism is not limited to non-union environments. For many of our union clients, they would tell you that other than times in which they're negotiating a successor agreement, there often is a three-year period where they don't hear anything from their union business agent. Those joint union management committees that you find in the very back of a collective bargaining agreement really are never engaged. And maybe other than a grievance or two, not only has there been labor peace, but most of all, there's been labor silence. And not now. Unions are calling meetings. They are demanding bargaining over hazard pay. They're sending information requests about what is contained in an employer's COVID-19 policy. They're filing ULPs over management's delay in meeting and conferring over the impact of a variety of employer decisions. They are negotiating and will be negotiating pandemic-related clauses, which would have been unheard of just 3 months ago. And they are orchestrating, promoting, and assisting workers in work stoppages, strikes, and there's been picketing, not only in these industries, but many more, and more are on the horizon. So we've heard a lot about how things will never return to normal. There will be a new normal for us in both our personal and professional lives. And for the remaining hour, we're going to delve into more specifics about what we've seen, what we've heard, and most importantly, what you can do to get ahead of this. So let me pass the mic to Mark Nelson, who will be discussing what we're seeing with non-union companies. Mark?
Thank you, Rob. Rob very ably discussed some of the critical issues that all employers will be facing in the way in which employers address these issues or preempt these issues in terms of dialogue with their employees will determine the extent to which they may be subject to union organizing activity. And as a cautionary guidance, we advise every employer to take the perspective that if not now, but in the near future, they will be subject to some sort of either union organizing activity or collective activism from among some segment of its workforce. As Rob said, we've been monitoring this for many, many years, and I, in my practice, have been working with employers in labor matters for over 30 years and have not seen a set of circumstances like what we are experiencing right now at any point in my career. Certain issues that will be critical, Rob has talked about job security, whether it's unionized workforce or not. What we have seen is unions have been unable to prevent furloughs and permanent layoffs. And in future negotiations, that will the union's positions on that may most likely become much more demanding in terms of guarantees, and not a process regarding layoffs, but a commitment to not lay off or to do something to minimize the economic harm of employees who are subject to layoff. Safety protections, will be a paramount concern in most every single business environment. Increased leave and time off and improved benefits programs, many of which follow from the actions that the federal government has taken to attempt to minimize or reduce the negative impact of COVID-19 on employees across the country. Another thing to consider is when we look at COVID-19, as Rob said, we go back less than 3 months and look at the world then and now. During this period, persons of color lost jobs at a greater rate than others. For example, in April, Latinos had the highest unemployment rate at 18.9%. African-American workers' unemployment rate jumped from 6.7% to 16.7%. And many times those folks who are not affected by that are working in essential positions and subject to the challenges and the stresses that Rob identified earlier. And if unemployment rates continue to rise, as many experts predict, these numbers will only get worse, leading to more negative reactions and views and stress and outrage among employees. And then we now have a new dynamic, the protests regarding triggered by George Floyd's death across the country regarding police treatment of African Americans and non-whites. And it is almost inevitable that this will lead to a broader, larger discussion of equality of opportunity. And there is no question that part of the union strategy will likely be to capitalize on these emotions and this dynamic in organizing activity. But before COVID-19, unions were seeing significant improvement in their organizing opportunities and gains in decades. Rob's already identified a number of them. In fact, union approval rates have been above 60% for the past 3 years for the first time in multiple decades. So the level of support or possible interest in union organizing activity is significantly higher than it has been, and it's trending upward. And as Rob referred to, the Fight for 15, there was moderate success, but it created focus on pay rates. And a dynamic to try and increase minimum pay rates across the country. Some would say, well, if legislation creates $15 an hour pay rates, which are higher than in many union collective bargaining agreements, how can unions try and sell the value of their services? Well, they'll focus on other areas in terms of job protection, safety, where they can claim state and federal governments are falling down on jobs. And then when you look at the impact of unemployment insurance and that guarantee, that will find its way, if not into federal legislation, quite probably into state and local legislation, and employees will have a higher expectation, perhaps demands at the bargaining table, for better protection from sudden and unanticipated downturns in the economy. And another significant point and a kind of an inverse dynamic is workers who are considered essential and are working under onerous conditions are now being paid less to work in these hazardous conditions than their peers who are unemployed and receiving $600 a week from the federal government. One other point here is if your organization has received any COVID-19 related loans or other funding, you should understand whether and how the union neutrality obligations in that law affect you. It's complex and it's vague right now, but it could have a significant impact on the organization's future with respect to loan repayment and other obligations. What we have here are some telltale signs of union organizing activity. Now, this is in union organizing activity under the traditional approach before the digital era and digital union organizing. The overriding concept is to be aware of changes in employee behavior in the workplace. And some of the typical examples are set forth here in that employees getting together, whether at work or offsite, and who don't normally socialize together. Or you find employees visiting others in work areas where neither employee or one employee normally belongs. A significant increase in questions relative to wages, benefits, job security protections, or company policies and procedures, whether that's safety or otherwise. Certainly a critical telltale sign is presence of any union-related literature, whether it's on bulletin boards within the company's premises, in break rooms, locker rooms, in windshields, in vehicles parked inside company parking lots. Those are a sign of concern. Significant employee turnover where upon review of exit interview data suggests that something is not right for the reasons offered for the departures of a significant number of employees. Lastly, employee attendance at union-sponsored meetings. The touchstone, though, is that in this age, unions are using digital organizing, social media such as Facebook, Reddit, Instagram, and the use of closed, secure rooms hosted by the unions for the express purpose of organizing, which means that employers are less likely to be aware of organizing going on. What should you do if contacted by a union? I always go by the advice, beware of strangers bearing gifts. If a union representative or a group of employees request to meet or present something to a CEO or CHO, do not accept the package. Do not look at anything. Do not open it. And if you do not open it, you're in good shape. And if you receive something like that, have a witness and then call your labor attorney to get guidance on what you do with this unwanted gift. And with that, I will pass it to Sarah Robertson, who will move forward.
Thanks, Mark. After spending some time discussing what types of organizing activities non-unionized employers should be vigilant and monitoring, we're going to kind of take a step back now and review what the National Labor Relations Act is and what rights it grants employees. So the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, and the Act seeks to correct the inherent inequality in bargaining power between employers and employees by promoting collective bargaining between employers on one hand and trade unions working on behalf of employees on the other hand. The NLRA established various rules concerning collective bargaining and defined a series of banned unfair labor practices. The NLRA also established the National Labor Relations Board to enforce the Act, including the prosecution of violations of the Act and oversight of the election process by which employees decide whether to be represented by a labor organization. These processes are initiated at the regional offices of the NLRB, of which there are currently 26, based on your location in the country. The Act grants employees two basic rights. First is to form, join, or assist a union, including in collective bargaining, and second, to engage in concerted activities for mutual aid or protection, which includes any effort by two or more employees to improve pay, benefits, or working conditions. Implicitly, the Act also employees who refrain from engaging in these activities, except as otherwise required by a collective bargaining agreement as a condition of employment. It's important to note, as we've discussed throughout, that the Act applies to both unionized and non-unionized workplaces, so all employers should be cognizant of its requirements. So the crux of the Act hinges on protected concerted activity. And Section 7 of the NLRA provides that employees shall have the right to self-organization, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively, and to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or mutual aid or protection. This sets out the general principle that employees have the right to join a union and engage in collective bargaining. Section 8 of the NLRA refers to Section 7 and defines a set of prohibited actions by employers, employees, and unions known as unfair labor practices. There are five unfair labor practices aimed at employers, which are found in Section 8A. The most common unfair labor practice is found in subsection 1, which makes it unlawful for an employer to interfere with, restrain, or coerce employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights. This includes the employee's freedom of association, mutual aid or protection, self-organization, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively for wages and working conditions through representatives, and to engage in other protected concerted activities with or without a union. It has a very broad scope and something that all employers should be vigilant for. If an employer interferes with employees engaging in protected concerted activities or retaliates against employees for engaging in protected concerted activities, either with or without the presence of a union, it has violated Section 8. So the question becomes, what is a protected concerted activity? It's an activity that affects the terms and conditions of employment, think wages, benefits, hours of work, working conditions or safety, that involves employee commentary, including verbal speech, written documents and speech, social media, or other modern electronic platforms, including text messaging, by two or more employees, including individuals that are working together to advance a change in working conditions. However, it does not include individual one-off personal gripes that are not concerted in nature. It's helpful to discuss protected concerted activities with regard to examples. So in response to COVID and its effect on the workplace, we're seeing an increase in employees engaging in protected activity. Some relevant examples that apply to the COVID situation are as follows. An employee speaking to a supervisor on behalf of other employees about a lack of sanitation supplies. This is protected concerted activity because it involves terms and conditions of employment, which is sanitation supplies. It involves commentary, which is an employee speaking to a supervisor, and it's concerted in that the single employee is speaking on behalf of a broader group of employees. Another example is an employee posts on social media complaining about the workforce's inadequate PPE. The terms and conditions of employment impacted here is the PPE. The commentary is social media. The board has often taken the position that social media posts or conversations about workplace issues are protected so long as they are directed at terms and conditions of employment rather than disparagement of the employer or general independent gripes. This is also concerted because even though it is only one employee posting in this example, the employee is speaking on behalf of others with the assumption that the inadequate PPE extends to the entire workforce or a larger group of employees. Another example is employees circulating a petition asking for paid sick leave. This is becoming common for employees or employers who are not covered by the FFCRA or employers who are covered and employees are seeking expanded paid sick leave that they might not otherwise be entitled to under the law. The terms and conditions of employment here is paid sick leave. The commentary is the petition, which is written speech, and it's concerted in that several employees are engaged in the activity. Finally, several employees walk out of work to protest working conditions. As Rob discussed earlier, this is becoming common with a lot of logistics, retail, restaurant, businesses that tend to have lower wages but are exposed to significant risks associated with COVID. The terms and conditions here is really just any working condition. It can stem from a lack of hazard pay, inadequate PPE, staffing of and staggering of shifts, or a combination of the above. The commentary here is the physical act of walking out of work, and it's concerted in that a group of employees are engaging in it. So while it seems like protected concerted activity is broad, because it is, there are some instances in which an employee can forfeit the act's protections, and that depends on a multi-factor test. For example, there is not protected concerted activity when a single employee posts a review on Yelp or a similar website disparaging or defaming the employer's product or service without any relation to complaints about the workplace. Last, I wanted to touch on the administration. So we strongly advise that all employers take their obligations under the Act seriously and do not rely on the current administration to provide shelter or protection in the event of violations of the Act. It was widely expected following the 2016 election that the board, which is currently comprised of three members appointed by our president, would be employer-friendly. Many experts anticipated the board would advance employer initiatives and work quickly to roll back many of the previous administration's rulings and interpretations. But that has not quite been the case. There have also not been swift shifts in policy and decisions at the regional level, who importantly oversee elections and handle the vast majority of unfair labor practice charges. Of course, with it being an election year, there is also a potential for a change in administration, which could result in a reversion to the more employee-friendly policies and positions taken by the Obama-era board. This is not to get political, but just to remind employers, whether you're currently unionized or not, you should be aware of the Act's requirements and diligently seek to comply, as the board of present or future is not likely to provide significant shelter or protection in the event the employer commits unfair labor practice charges. And with that, I'm going to pass the mic off to Denise to talk about bargaining issues.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you again for being part of this webinar, and I hope that every one of the companies that you work for or with or run are thanking you too, because the fact that you're taking time to be on webinars like this puts you so far ahead of the curve as far as dealing with these issues. The point of this presentation is to help you issue spot and know when you are going to be in a situation that you're going to end up in legal hot water or miss something that's going on when it comes to unionizing or dealing with your unions, and it can feel a little overwhelming when we're covering all this detailed legal ground. I do want to just emphasize that if you can leave this seminar today and have a better sense of, hey, I think that this may be one of those issues they were talking about, and give us a call, I don't want you to get overwhelmed with everything we're saying, because when you call us, then the goal switches to you're telling us what your business need and issue is, and that's where we can translate all these legal obligations that we've talked about and that I'm about to go through in more detail into getting you to the goal that you have. All right, let's start with some considerations specifically for unionized workforces. Bargaining over the impact effects of the pandemic, midterm bargaining issues and reopeners, increased joint labor management meetings, economic and safety considerations as you're bargaining, protected concerted activity over workplace concerns. What the heck does that all mean? Okay, when it comes to unionized employers, you are going to have a legal obligation still through all of this to bargain in good faith as law requires on wages, hours, and other working conditions of employment. But there's going to be very urgent and rapidly changing demands that you have. So how do you reconcile those two things? You're also going to be need to crafting new policies on safety protocols, layoff issues, sick leaves, and all of these potentially trigger that duty to bargain. So some of the steps that you should be taking as you are experiencing or being introduced to these considerations is remember to be checking your contract or have us taking a look. What is your language on management rights? How much latitude do you have? What's your language on health and safety issues, on leave of absences and PTO? There may be situations that you do have more room for unilateral action on these points, and that can be particularly important when we're in this COVID-19 era because we're not going to have as much time to wait around to make some of these changes. When you're in an emergent situation, giving prompt notice to the union of your plan changes and the opportunity to bargain and requesting that is important, as well as emphasizing when circumstances are particularly exigent. If the union's delaying in moving forward when you do have an obligation to bargain, document that fact, document those conversations, and work with us so that we can either get you to a point of when and how you need to be sitting down with the union, for how long, what kind of points you need to raise, or documenting the fact that that does not become possible so that we're avoiding unfair labor practice charges, or if they're filed, you have the evidence that you need to refute those. Usually you're going to have some latitude to assign different job tasks if employees can do it and work safely and are trained. You may be looking now at reassigning people in ways you never have. For example, I've been working with a lot of employers on these contact tracing issues where let's say that someone comes down with COVID-19 in your workforce and you're having to go back 14 days to see who has that person been working with, who may need to be exited from the workforce due to concerns after someone's symptomatic. Well, in order to best facilitate that, it behooves you to limit the number of employees that are working together. Let's say that you have a job site that's a construction job site, and before employees were freely moving about and interacting with a number of different coworkers. Now you may be looking at wanting to limit it to teams of people so that if there is a mini outbreak, you can say, all right, it's only those five employees that someone's been working with. But again, we need to do this within the parameters of the CBA that you have. Sometimes you're going to have to pay more if there's a different job classification, or again, you're going to be limited with the language and even reassigning the work. Schedule changes are always going to be even trickier than that under the language of most contracts. So we just need to be really aware that depending on the language of the agreement and the circumstances you're facing, you want to avoid direct dealing on reducing hours or changing schedules where the contract would prohibit it. Again, I want to emphasize, like I did at the outset, the point of this information that we're giving is not to say that we're trying to put handcuffs on you in implementing the changes and the solutions that you need in order to accomplish your business objectives. Sometimes it's about showing your work to get to the same solution or about tweaking some of that approach so that you're not running afoul of the law. Layoffs and furloughs are a huge issue right now, and they're going to continue to be. I think we're in this temporary, seeming like it's going to be very temporary, state of a little bit of calm. People are returning to work in non-essential businesses. Essential businesses that have been working this whole time are feeling like they're really hitting their stride. We very likely could see another huge outbreak as far as COVID-19, particularly given the protests that are happening across the country. So when it comes to layoffs, remember that you're going to need to bargain with the union in most cases when you're doing that due to the economic impact of COVID. This includes the decision, the effects of that, items like health insurance continuation, severance, bumping rights, return to work scenarios. Not to say that you can't be taking these steps, we just need to approach it in the right way and with the right specific messaging and language. It doesn't prevent your actions, but it can also impact the timing of them and just slow you down ever so slightly. The problem is, if we're not bargaining on these points that I just addressed, you can end up with big financial liability. You can end up with issues in the media and the press. You can end up with low employee morale, particularly as the union seizes on those shortcomings by you to emphasize not only how bad the changes that you need to make, but also framing it as how little you care about the employee, that you're not going about it in the correct way. As far as midterm bargaining issues and contract reopeners, how can you bargain if you have to proceed immediately with a change? There was a memo released by the general counsel for the NLRB, and we've got a blog post up about it, but essentially the general counsel reminded us that there are past decisions that address what you can do when there's an economic exigency that compels prompt action. The employer bears the burden of proof in these scenarios. So again, we need to make sure that we help you show your work, so to speak, when you are needing to proceed immediately and that you're taking the right steps to be able to do that. But there are situations where the NLRB has recognized that when there's external events beyond your control that aren't foreseeable and have a major economic effect, you can proceed with action as long as you're giving as much notice as possible. I don't know that this is, I don't think we have a specific bullet on this point, but it was referenced by Rob earlier. Information requests. Some of you are getting inundated with information requests from the union. And of course, there is a legal obligation when the union is requesting information and documents that the employer has to respond within, I think it's a reasonable period of time. Some of these information requests have included, or if you haven't gotten them, you can expect at some point to get them, requests on providing paid time off, safety at work, potential layoffs, lists of employees that are furloughed, who you're contesting unemployment for and who you're not, issues under the FFCRA for the paid leave and the time off for families. So let's just remind ourselves what we have a duty to provide and what we don't. A key mistake would be to ignore these. And sometimes what we see happen is there's lower level management or supervisors that are getting these requests. And right now, people are in such a period of being overwhelmed in responding to these COVID-19 issues that it's easy for some of these to seem so unreasonable or so out of bounds that they wouldn't warrant a response. There's a duty to provide information that already exists to the union. We don't have to be speculating or creating information to provide to them. If there are specific questions that a document or policy that's already in place answers, typically you can provide that. If there's a policy in the works that the union is aware is in the works, then like for example, how you'll pay employees who can't come to work due to exposure, quarantining, especially if you're not covered under FFCRA, would be one example. You may not have to provide it right away because it's still in process, but there's going to be a continuing duty to provide when available. So you need to set those reminders for yourself to timely provide that. There's no hard and fast rules on the time to respond to these requests, but let us help you on that, especially as far as communicating to the union when we're trying to buy time or need more time. There's a way to say that the information's coming that's better said certain ways than others. And there's a way to push back that time frame, but we have to do it the right way. And a lot of that can be used as an opportunity to reiterate things like, you know, we're taking X amount of time on this because we're diligently trying to research all the options for employees, have a full understanding of federal and state obligations, et cetera, et cetera. You may run into requests, or probably will, that ultimately seek information about employees' medical issues relating to COVID, who's had COVID-19, who's had symptoms, et cetera. There's confidential medical information involved with these that have implications under state privacy laws and the ADA. So let's make sure we're exploring things like, why do they need that information? How can we narrow it? What kind of releases do we need? Some of you do this and some of you don't. It's always something that I try to move people towards, which is joint labor management meetings. And for those of you who are saying, well, what does that mean exactly? Do you mean just collective bargaining when the contract comes up? No, it's something different. This refers to trying to be collaborative with the union, which I know is just going to be easier in some situations than others, depending on the union involved in the relationship. But having like a regular, whether it's monthly or every other month, opportunity where even if there's no pending issues, you have a designated time that you're sitting down and really meeting with the union to try to get out in front of issues before they're happening or creating a problem. This is going to be another good way to help protect yourself, as then you ultimately are needing to make quicker changes. It's a good message to have with employees. Again, this is something that we can help you frame how to do correctly and how to maximize these opportunities. But given the rapid changes that we're having right now, it will go a long way not only into smoothly making those changes, but also if later there is some sort of an unfair labor practice charge filed about your unwillingness to work with the union or some sort of unilateral change that you're implementing, this would be a good argument to make refuting that. There is a number of different workplace concerns that are arising that relate to protected concerted activity right now with COVID, and it boils down to this. Employees are genuinely scared right now about what's happening. They're afraid about coming to work and getting COVID-19. They're being fed misinformation by a lot of these unions, and I've seen it in actual memos and letters that unions are preparing that are saying things like, go home if you're afraid. Even if it's totally unwarranted. Unions are not, in every case, in most cases, advising employees that they have a lot of new federal rights under things like the FFCRA or under bigger employers' policies that they're implementing to protect workers. Workers aren't being reminded that they have FMLA and ADA rights. Instead, there's a stirring of the pot that's happening. And so I think what really is some genuine fear in a lot of situations is being capitalized on by the unions. For example, unions are telling employees to refuse to come to work if they've got this generalized fear. There are some different considerations about employee rights in this regard. Depends on things like, are you an essential business or a non-essential business? What does your stay-at-home order say? Some of them say, for example, for non-essential businesses, that where a worker does not want to come in because they're afraid of working, that they have certain job-protected unpaid leave in that situation. It's going to be different for essential workers, where I have actually seen employers in some cases not be aggressive enough in pushing back on employees that are just in a general way saying, I'm afraid to come to work. There's a stay-at-home order, so I don't have to come back until, quote, everything returns to normal. And we don't know how many months or years that could be. If an employee is saying, I'm not going to work, ask some questions and really understand what's going on there. Is there a situation that is covered under one of the applicable laws like the FFCRA? Is the employee actually ill, or do they have a family member that's actually ill from COVID-19, a child that's home for school that has a bona fide need for the person to care from them? Can the employee work from home? What do your leave of absence provisions say under both your policies and your CBA? Is the employee reasonably believing that they're in imminent danger? And if so, why? And then there's going to be some OSHA retaliation considerations. Be aware that our normal adage of work now, grieve later may not apply in all these situations. And again, there's also a lot of practical considerations. For example, I've seen outbursts that have happened where it's ended up in bad press for employers because they haven't correctly addressed these employee concerns, even if they ultimately are going to say, you've got to come to work, you're an essential worker, you really don't have a legitimate basis for this refusal. It's all about the correct messaging and verbiage. And be aware, too, that a lot of your written communications to employees on any of these points are very ripe for posting on social media or being given to the press. There are going to be situations, too, that you need to be alert for where if employees are coming together to refuse to work, that may be protected concerted activity under Section 7, and then you can really end up in some hot water if we're not handling that correctly. Unionized employees who are walking off the job in protest of safety issues, such as not having the right kind of equipment, may be protected from discipline or discharge under a safe harbor provision of the NLRA. This is a complicated analysis, but basically when unionized employees have a good faith belief supported by ascertainable and objective evidence that there's an abnormally dangerous working condition, a refusal to work may be protected even in cases where there's a no strike clause. I think I failed to advance to my next slide. Here we go. Some questions that you're going to want to ask when you're evaluating strikes or work stoppages and developing contingency plans are looking at things like, how are we going to replace striking workers? Is the work stoppage protected? Is there an entitlement to pay benefits or unemployment compensation? What are the consequences going to be if you get the analysis wrong? And are you doing a careful enough analysis? And what recourse do you have? The one surprising aspect of the application of the National Labor Relations Act to our current situation is that these rules I'm talking about can apply in many cases even when the business or individual is part of the essential or life-sustaining infrastructure. So you're getting some conflicting messages to some degree as we're going through all the law in these different areas, because on the one hand, you're looking at stay-at-home orders or you're looking at return-to-work orders and thinking they've got to get back to work, but then you add in these very complicated National Labor Relations Act laws and protections, some of which we really haven't applied to a situation like the one we're in now, and so it leads to a lot of potential for confusion. What are some best proactive practices to be implementing and considering? I want to talk first about some considerations with respect to contract negotiations with the union and the policies that you have. First of all, if you're in the midst of contract negotiations that were scheduled, you are going to likely have an obligation to consider those negotiations, to look at things like remote bargaining, to document efforts that the union is making to delay based on any of those considerations. Or if you're going to delay bargaining, it needs to be through conversations with the union, through extension agreements, and resuming bargaining later, but both sides being on the same page. I will say that when we were at the outset of all this COVID-19 stuff, there was a mentality of resuming bargaining, quote, when the current crisis is over. I don't think that's practical or advisable, because this is going to go on for a long time. We think that there will be surges that come. I think that there are new approaches that we're going to just have to get used to in some respects as far as moving ahead with bargaining, moving ahead with arbitrations in unionized environments. And we've come up with a lot of really good solutions that are working well that we can help you with on all of those points. There's opportunities here too that we need to keep in mind. So it's not all bad news, even though times feel dark right now. As far as legal strategy when it comes to your management labor relations, there, as mentioned earlier, are going to be a lot of new provisions that are put on the table by unions for consideration during contract negotiations that focus on issues like masks, pay for safety stewards, other safety provisions, protections in events of furloughs and layoffs, the language that they have regarding seniority and job protections. Well, with all of those new protections that unions are trying to gain, let's be proactive now about thinking, even aside from COVID-19 related issues, what gains are we and have we been looking to get in some of our contracts that were trickier to bargain for? And now we have some additional bargaining power because there are going to be additional items that the unions want when they come to the table. And let's think strategically about what else we need to get accomplished with our contracts. We are working with most of our clients right now on proactive looks, even for those who aren't in contract negotiations, about what does our current contract say, what do we need to be thinking about in light of this new era we're in, and how are we preparing really early for future negotiations so that we're not missing opportunities and we're not stepping on our toes with failing to think through as much of the complicated issues that COVID's bringing as we can and looking at those in the future. Force majeure provisions are having new significance. You know, a year ago, no one was thinking about things like masks or other personal protective equipment just in your run-of-the-mill workplaces. So those are all new areas. It's also a good time right now as far as being proactive to be revisiting your policies, looking at protections like now that we have safety concerns, how does that affect solicitation and distribution policies and permitting of third parties to access the work environment, looking at, okay, you know, social media now more than ever is going to be a primary way that unions are communicating and that information is being communicated about your company. We want to make sure both that you're protecting the company as much as possible on those forums and also, again, not running afoul of the protections for employees to engage in protected concerted activity when it comes to spreading complaints or concerns via social media and educating your supervisors about that. Supervisor training is paramount right now, not just with respect to issues under the NLRA, but just management best practices training right now is one of the very best things you can do. We've been doing a lot of that lately, and I have seen that now more than ever where I'm going in and doing management best practices training that weaves in some of these issues, employee leave and ADA accommodation issues, as well as appropriate discipline and documentation and discharge practices. It's better received now more than ever because employees want to hear from you. They want to understand what's going on. They want their managers to be able to communicate with them in a compassionate and informed way. And some of the biggest problems that we see, it's of course not from those of you on the call. The fact that you even know you need to educate yourselves about these issues means you're not going to be the ones running afoul of this. It's going to be your frontline supervisors and managers that if you don't give them the right tools to implement safe practices, to talk to your employees about their fear about COVID, and to handle these issues, things are going to blow up in your face. The other thing we need to be educating supervisors on is that now enforcing health and safety practices is part of their job. You know, telling employees that they need to be not touching their face, that they need to be wearing masks, that they need to be sticking to the guidelines for contact tracing. All of those are part of their responsibility, but you got to tell them that that's the case. And then finally, there need to be good points of contact for careful and quick responses when an employee reports symptoms of COVID. If the media is calling one of your managers or supervisors to ask about things like furlough or about an outbreak on the job site, it really would behoove you to consider having almost a 24-hour person, and that's going to be, you know, different people who are rotating through that, where people know, you know, during this time frame, that's the cell phone that you call if you've got a symptomatic employee or if the media is coming to your site. Or for those of you that are non-unionized, if there are, you know, people from a union that are on that job site and that are causing issues. So those are some considerations for you. We're going to conclude this with Henry Thomas.
Thanks, Denise. And that's actually leads us to our next slide. I'm going to be talking about what not to say during union organizing. Denise just talked about best practices and educating supervisors, especially during union organizing. This is how you can be successful in a union campaign and successfully avoid an unfair labor practice charge that Sarah talked about earlier. It's a pretty simple acronym, but it's important to kind of, it's an easy way of summarizing what we are as employers prohibited from doing to respect employee rights and avoid a general kind of garden variety ULP, and that's SPIT. S stands for spy, P promise, I interrogate, and T threaten. It's a pretty easy way to keep track of what, when you're educating your employers, what you are not allowed to do or say. We talked about S for spy or surveillance. Employers should educate their supervisors and frontline managers that even the appearance of spying should be avoided. Generally, employers, the NLRA has found or prohibits statements that appear to spy on union activities. Don't ask coworkers to spy on union activities. Specific examples of surveillance could include impermissible surveillance or spying, can include taking pictures of employees who are going into a union meeting, telling employees that others have said that they're a union supporter, listening in on employee conversations or taking notes of employee conversations. Because of this, generally, you know, management should never attend a union meeting, even if management is invited, and should always avoid even the appearance of any sort of spying or surveillance. Promises. A business cannot interfere in the organizing efforts by assuring employees that the company will make things better for them if they just keep the union out. This is just as illegal as making a threat. Generally, don't make or act on any promises of a benefit in return for a coworker not engaging in union activity. Specific examples of promises can include, impermissible promises can include agreeing to address grievances during a campaign, offering pay increases or better benefits, or promising promotions or special treatment to employees for supporting the company rather than the union. Don't interrogate. It is illegal to ask employees about their support of the union or to ask about the alignment of their peers with regard to supporting the union. Here's some general examples are listed, but some specific examples of impermissible interrogation can include asking employees to give the names of those who attended, you know, organizing barbecue or organizing picnic. Polling employees to see who is a company supporter and who is a union supporter, or seeking grievances from employees during an organizing campaign. These are all impermissible under the Act. Don't threaten. T stands for threats. It is illegal to threaten or carry out threats against employees because of their support for a union. We've listed some general threats here. Kind of some more specific examples that are hopefully illustrative and helpful can include telling employees that the company will close a work location or a plant if they vote for union representation, disciplining an individual or terminating their employment because an employee supports the union, or making statements about cutting off benefits or reducing pay once a union is in place. These are threats that that are impermissible under the Act. So we get a lot of employers who ask, what can I do? If these are all things that you can't do, if they're, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and not say anything. That's exactly what the union's hoping you think. Not saying anything is the worst thing you can do. Although we just went through those four kind of general topics as to what you can't do, SPIT, there are hundreds of things you can do. And if the employee, just remember that if the employees don't hear the facts from you, then they're only hearing one side of the story. And it's your job to help them become educated on the process and make informed decisions. There's a protection in the Act that allows employers under HC to provide that provides protections in their free speech. 8C permits employers to make statements or share opinions so long as it doesn't fall under one of those categories under SPIT. So what can employers say about unions? You can share your facts, opinion, and experience. It's a simple acronym, FOE. It is legal and allowable to encourage managers to share the facts regarding the union and help set expectations relative to the organizing process. Educating your management about how they can let employees know what the company can legally do and what the union can legally do is permissible. Also, you can cite the specific facts, such as under federal labor law, so long as the parties negotiate a contract in good faith, an employee may make less than they currently do if a union is put in place. You can educate employees about the facts surrounding union dues, that the union dues may add up to several hours of pay. Employees are also allowed to share opinions and experiences, F, O, and E, and those are based on a person's individual experience at a prior job that had a union come in, or a manager's opinion as to, the fact that they believe a union hasn't been relevant for 50 years, or, in my opinion, I rather address employee issues directly with an employee rather than a stranger like a union steward. Overall, and I want to wrap up to be mindful of your time, but overall, there are things employers can do, and the goal is to avoid employers feeling like they're handcuffed, and that's kind of going to what Denise is saying. That's what we're here to help, or your labor council, is to help you help employees become educated as to what the negotiation and organizing process will be and what we are as a company allowed to do. I know we are wrapping up, so I appreciate your time for joining, especially with everything that's going on, and I want to thank everybody for their participation. I'm going to hand it over to Emma to do a quick wrap up.
Thank you. Yes, this concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation and copy of the slides will be available on the Pulse Nelly website and our COVID-19 blog within 24 hours. If you have questions regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 support email as seen on the screen now. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.